Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to Sunstone, and we welcome to you to session 225, entitled Re-Exploring the Geocultural Politics of the Deep West. Our speaker today is Craig Decker. We're pleased to welcome him. A bit about Craig. Craig has a PhD in political science from MIT. He is part of the fifth generation of a pioneering Utah family, and he is currently working on a guidebook to the history, art, and culture of the Deep West and its corners. We look forward to an excellent presentation today. And now, Craig, thank you.
Well, I want to welcome you. Since we're a small group, I'm going to run this kind of informally, more as a workshop. So I'd invite you to all come up a little closer, maybe the front or second row. And maybe since we're a small group, we could just go around quickly and introduce yourselves, your name, and maybe a sentence on why you were interested in this session or whatever.
Sean Truman, political scientist, Boise, Idaho.
Ross Anderson. I'm interested in culture, so this was fascinating to maybe look into some of the different cultural components that make up our region.
My name is Gary Whittison. I've long had a curiosity as to whether the deep conservatism of Utah Mormons is a result of their religion or just a result, a byproduct of being part of the West here. I'm interested to see how that intersects.
I'm I was born and raised in Washington State and came down here to go to the Y, and I have been very fascinated too with the cultures, and I thought, well, this would be a great one for me to find out more about the cultures.
I'm Ralph Woodward, raised in Salt Lake City, lived in California, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. Yesterday we couldn't even find our way. That dang 24 parking lot, we could never find it.
Yeah. Something geopolitical about that. What was your name again?
Gary Whittison.
And my name is Kufray Ekpenyang. I'm a student at the Y, a convert to the church, and I grew up in Baltimore trying to understand more about the West. So.
Okay, great. So let's keep this informal. If you have a question at any point, just ask it or comment. And anything that I say that you don't understand or want me to elaborate on, we can do that since we have a small group. I'll try to remember to repeat the question since they're recording this, I guess, if I can. This is my first Sunstone meeting, and it's quite exciting. I have kind of a little anecdote here. In researching the Deep West, I live in Phoenix, Arizona, which is kind of on the edge of the Deep West, as I consider it. But every few months, I come up to Salt Lake to do some research on the Deep West. I was up here, you know, before Easter, and I saw that the Mormons were having their general conference. And I naively assumed it was something like this, you know, and that I'd go and there'd be little sessions and exchanging information and everything. So that was a kind of I went anyway. It was interesting. I enjoyed the Tabernacle Choir, but I admire your questing and seeking truth and finding it very interesting. And I think I'm kind of involved in an analogous effort where many of you are kind of define yourself in a borderline, sort of on the fringe with Orthodox Mormonism. I would define myself as a borderline Southwesterner. And this effort to define the Deep West has been kind of an on and off project for the last 20 or so years since I first moved out to Phoenix. When I first moved there, one of the first things somebody told me was there are two kinds of people in Arizona, Phoenix people and Tucson people. And that could mean different things, but I take it to mean that Tucson was more into the roots and the history and the environment and a smaller community, and Phoenix was more into full speed ahead and golf courses and being like L.A. or trying to be like L.A. And, you know, while that analogy doesn't completely hold up, I think, you know, I think you can see people that live on the edge of the Deep West. The Deep West is kind of defined in terms of the edges and the internal corners. But I think of my, I thought of myself as a Tucson person, and now I think of myself as more a Deep West person living in Phoenix. So I'm going to start by talking about defining, inventing, or imagining the Deep West, and I think it's analogous to what many borderline Sunstoners have to do, is kind of redefining what, in terms of Mormon culture, what they want to take or what they want to rethink or so on. And so I think this is an analogous project and probably compatible with, you know, thinking in terms of where you live or what your home region is. And this mainly grew out of a dissatisfaction with the definition of the Southwest. It's an ambiguous concept. I mean, sometimes it includes the whole Southwest quarter, you know, including Oklahoma and Texas and California. Sometimes most commonly it's kind of limited to Arizona and New Mexico and maybe a little bit of the Four Corners up here. Sometimes it's defined as a four corner state. But this effort to create the idea of the Deep West was deep, corresponds to south because it's kind of south, but also I thought of deep of looking at the deeper structure of the Southwest. There's an analogy to, I don't know if you know about, you know, work on the deep structure of language or the deep structure of myths, the kind of underlying archetypes that define myths and so on. And deep ecology is another kind of influence. It talks about looking more deeply at the cultural roots of ecology and so on and the meaning. So while I can define the kind of boundaries of what I think of as the Deep West, what I'm interested in is a deeper cultural structure, and how do you get at that? How do you know your own region? And how do you know the Deep West? That's kind of what I'm struggling with. Any questions so far? Okay. Let's start with kind of my definition or conception of the Deep West, which you can start by defining the boundaries. I've done it in terms of highways to be convenient for looking on a map, but it also corresponds with geological edges too. So if you start up here in Denver, which is one of the edges of the Four Corners, and go down Route 125. You can go here to Albuquerque, which is another corner, and then you swing down here on Route 60, which I use. It's not an interstate, but it kind of defines the bottom Sonoran edge of the Deep West, and then you come to Phoenix, which is another corner, and then up to Las Vegas, which is fourth corner, and then up to Salt Lake, which is the fifth corner. And one kind of way that I like to think of it is borrowing from Gary Snyder's notion of Turtle Island of North America as kind of looking like a big turtle. You know, I think you can say the same thing for the Deep West, that it's kind of, so if you think of a deep West turtle kind of oriented south, little tail up here, then each its back paws would be Salt Lake and the Wasatch Front, and over here you have Denver and the Front Range, and its front paws would be Albuquerque down here, and Las Vegas over here. And then if you draw its little head sticking down there into the Sonoran edge there, and you have Phoenix. So that's another way of kind of thinking of what the Deep West encompasses.
That's right, guys.
Yeah.
What distinguishes this from, or why would you not include Idaho, Wyoming, Montana when you talk about the Deep West? Is there something that distinguishes the South from the North when you're talking about geopolitics?
Well, I guess a couple of things. I mean, other people would define the Deep West in other ways. I've tried to define it in kind of taking the areas that I thought were interesting. I'm interested in history and cultural clashes and current cultural clashes. So I tried to define kind of the minimum area that I thought gave me a good way of looking at those clashes. The thing that I felt like just defining the Southwest down here as Arizona and New Mexico, which it's often culturally defined there's a lot of interesting things happening out there, but you leave out, for example, the whole Mormon pioneering tradition, which I think is real important, and it's hard to understand this region if you don't start at least include a good part of Utah. And I also think if you leave out the Colorado Rockies, there's that whole tradition of kind of Yankee operators, miners, and railroaders coming in and settling the Front Range and then moving in here. And so I think the way I put together the Deep West was in terms of five cultural areas, and you can see them kind of highlighted on this map or this map. First, you have northern New Mexico, which is kind of the area around Santa Fe, Taos, kind of the center there. Now, that's really the heart of what we think of when we think of the Southwest. We think of the Pueblos and the Hispanic influence and the artists, the Santa Fe artists and Taos artists. So that's really the heart. When you throw in Arizona, there's some of that history in Arizona, but Arizona is kind of different. I'll get back to Arizona. But so that's a very interesting area. Then up here, Utah. I mean, the whole history of the Mormons and their clashes with other social forces seems to me that's very interesting to include. And other people looking at the Southwest, you have lots of Mormon, like in the down here in the Little Colorado. There's a very interesting history of clashes there. But I think to leave out Utah, you miss a lot of that. Yeah. So that's the second component I feel is important. Then the center, the heart of it, what I think of as the native heartland, the Navajo culture and the Sunnis and the Hopis and everything. I think that's a real important and interesting part. And then Colorado, as I said before, the kind of, I think of that as being settled by kind of Yankee operators and entrepreneurs, the miners, the 59ers that came in, and the railroaders, the people that built the narrow line and so on. So I think that whole history is real interesting and important component. And then last, you have down here, Arizona, the top part of Arizona. I think of that more as kind of the last sustaining maverick culture. I think of the thing that Arizona is most known for is our maverick politicians and our general mavericks, and it was kind of settled by mavericks. It kind of took over. Phoenix, for example, was settled by a saloon owner that took over these ancient Hohokam ruins and took them over. So I think those are the kind of five areas that I define as the Deep West. And I'm most interested in kind of the cultural clashes, how they work together. And so that's kind of how I conceived it. Now, I think this is an individual thing. My Deep West doesn't have to be your Deep West. And even though I've defined the region here, you could define other things that were deep Western or fit in it that were outside. So an interesting exercise, I think, for you folks to do maybe sometimes with a map is to find your deep West, or maybe you want to call it something other than the deep West. Maybe you want to call it the high West or something. I don't know. I think the important thing is that you put what's important to you. So you were talking about Idaho. I mean, you could, for example, have included more of the Intermountain West. Now, that's another category that I think is kind of ill-defined and not that useful. I mean, it's more useful in that the Mormons are more present in it, but you don't have these other groups coming in there that are interesting, like the Colorado and the Santa Fe traders and so on coming up, and the Texas cattlemen coming up from there. So, but for your purposes, you might want to include more and draw it up here, or you might want to include more of the South here. I hated to leave out Tucson because, you know, that's that whole Hispanic culture down there, but I felt I got enough of that in. Or you might want to include a little more Colorado. So, I mean, the thing is that these boundaries are not hard and fast. So, does that answer your question? Okay. Now, I wanted to say a little about, how are we doing on time?
You're just fine. Yeah.
Okay. Could you tell me when we have about 15 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. I wanted to briefly sketch some of my influences that developed this theory, and I'm going to go through this quickly because I want to get on to other things. I don't want to spend much time, but it was useful for me to think in terms of, in kind of the conceptual guides or mentors that have kind of shaped these, into thinking of the four directions that are real important to the Native people. And so I thought in terms of one of my big influences was a planner called an urban planner called Lynch, who wrote this book on the image of the city, where he talks about how people navigate through cities, or you can apply this to regions as I am, through these mental maps they have. That they have cultural marks and ideas, and that's how they navigate through the cities. You that live in Salt Lake, I think Salt Lake is very visual and has some very strong cultural marks and everything. And I use that, and also the idea there that people create their own mental maps. I mean, people generally have some common things in terms of how they see the cities, in terms of districts and landmarks and paths that they use, but each one may be a little different, and that kind of inspired me to think in terms of creating my own thoughts about the Deep West and the components that make it up. Now, each of these directions, so this is kind of the east direction that I'm thinking of, so each of these directions I had kind of two people that I kind of, the ideas I kind of crunched together and play them off each other. So so I had Lynch here, and I also had Henry Adams. The Education of Henry Adams, you know, about his famous essay about the dynamo and the virgin. I mean, he was using that to give examples of cultural forces that clash with each other, and sometimes one replaces the other. And So where Lynch is mainly interested in the imageability of a city, common landmarks, I'm particularly interested in clashing landmarks or clashing cultural icons. You can think in Salt Lake. I mean, you have the temple, you have Fort Douglas, you know, the agents, you have the exchange of buildings there with the early anti-Mormons, and you have the twin towers of the two cathedrals. You have very powerful cultural marks, and so like Adams, I'm interested in more the clash between these and how you make sense of a community or region in terms of the different cultural icons or archetypes that have clashed. And down here in the West, I think in terms of regions, Meneg's, I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but the cultural geographer that did the landmark paper on the Mormon cultural region, and he also wrote a book on the Southwest as a region. So his interest, he influenced me in terms of thinking of cultural regions. And I was also influenced by various people in the bioregional movement. I don't know if you've heard of bioregionalism, but that's the whole idea that you know, defining your home place. And one of the powerful tools that they argue that it help you find home or find a sense of homeness in your region is by mapping it. And so there were people that did the mapping. So this whole idea of bioregionalism, cultural region, was influenced here. And to the West, I was influenced by a guy that writes a lot about books, Powell, who wrote this book on Southwest book trails. And his whole idea was kind of trailing books across the Southwest and talking about books that talked about the Southwest and so on. And I kind of extended that to think about traveling through the Deep West and looking at cultural trails, books and artifacts and so on. Another person down here that was influenced it was Stuart Brand and Whole Earth Catalog. I mean, what I kind of aspire to do is do a whole Deep West kind of catalog that would have different categories that would define the Deep West and help people that are traveling through or living there. And then last up here in the north, which the natives kind of see as night or the conceptual thinking area, I had Joseph Campbell's Heroes with a Thousand Faces, his ideas of archetypes and the typical myth tale, the different things that the heroes encounter. And I was crossed that with another person, Sanders, that particularly applied his idea to the Navajos, to the Navajo sand paintings and the Navajo ceremonies, and talked about the archetypes within them. So I think all these kind of work together to begin to get at a way of knowing the Deep West, or a deeper way of knowing it. So any questions so far? I wanted to... the Deep West has five edges, which are, I don't consider them necessarily part of the Deep West, but they're influential and right on them. These are the urban edges. So we have the Front Range here, Salt Lake City here. We have the Wasatch Range here. We have the Denver Front Range. We have the Albuquerque, Rio Grande kind of metropolitan down here. We have kind of two edges here on the desert. We have Phoenix and the Sonoran, and then Las Vegas concentration up here in the Mojave Desert. So those are kind of the edges, and those are kind of the gateways into the Deep West. I mean, if you're going to travel into the Deep West, you'd probably want to go to one of these places, go to museums, familiarize yourself before you went in. And then I defined realms within the Deep West as corners of the Deep West, or realms, and I define 14 of those, two groups of seven. Or you can divide them different ways, but... you have kind of western realms around here in green, and then you have the eastern realms or corners here that kind of are stacked up on each other, and then the heartland corners of the four corners. So I give these each kind of a name, like this is kind of the San Pete Valley is the center here, and I call that the Utah heartland. This over here is the dinosaur diamond here, and then you've got Southland, Dixie, and Iron, and then you've got Canyon Land here, Peaks Land here with the San Juan Peaks. Then you have, I call this checkered land here. This is kind of the checkerboard of the Navajo, and it has kind of a checkered past of, and also different groups coming in there to conflict there. So call that, call this native land. This is rim land here. This is Little River land, and so on. So each of the areas has its kind of own distinctive, you could see each of them as a distinctive bioregion. And each of them can be subdivided into what I call provinces. So like in this heartland, for instance, I see Provo as kind of the capital of the northernmost province of that, and then you have the towns, Manti and Ephraim and so on in the central, and then down here in the Seaver Valley you have Richfield and so on. So each of these areas kind of breaks up into three or four provinces. So how much more time?
Well, we have question and answer, but since you're incorporating that into the... you have about half an hour left.
Half an hour, yeah. Okay, good. And then within the provinces, you have districts, which are mainly the towns, the small towns, the urban area. And this whole area is really interesting because it's kind of inside out from most regions. You'd think of where the urban areas are kind of in the center, and then the rural areas are around an urban area. I mean, but this is kind of where the urban areas are on the edges, and then the inside is mainly rural and has, well, you have Flagstaff and a few small, medium-sized towns, but that's about it. And, well, Provo is pretty big if you include that, but it's kind of edgy. So within these you have districts, which are towns or smaller parts of districts. Like I think of, Falling Lynch, I think of different cultural districts. Like you could think of like Salt Lake. This would be another exercise that you might want to think of in terms of Lynch. Talks about how we have mental maps of districts and routes that we use and landmarks. And I think downtown Salt Lake is real interesting because you really have about seven cultural districts. You have probably, your most famous one is the Mormon one, the North. You have temple and lots of landmarks there. I mean, it's just full of cultural icons and landmarks. Then you have to the east, farther down, the avenues and so on, and down here, and you have your kind of your twin towers kind of guarding against the Mormon influence there. And so this is it. This east is here. And then the south, this was traditional, the business district and the place that the people that wanted to create businesses, non-Mormons that wanted to create a separate power base down here. So you still have some of that influence. And then you have the west, which is kind of a transportation hub and industry and stuff. And then in the center, you have kind of the no man's land where you have the south working up and the influence of the temple coming down, city center here is a real, more recent example of that. So you have a central, and then upper north, where you have the capital, and then the far east, the U of U district, cultural district, and you have Fort Douglas there as an icon and so on. So in each of these areas, each of the towns, you can think in terms of, what the cultural icons, like Ogden, is another good example. You have the fort there, and you have the temple, and you have the Air Force Base not far away, and you have the college, which is an important icon of learning, and so on. And you can do that for, like, any going through any town in the Deep West. Okay, now I think of layers of the Deep West. How do we get? How do we know a place more deeply? And I've thought about that. I think in terms of kind of a six-leaf flower here. And you have the stem and then six petals, which symbolize six layers of thinking about the Deep West. You could think of the petals as kind of falling off, like. So you have six layers, and then the seventh stem I include as a seventh kind of a way of exploring or traveling or that cuts through all the levels. And so at the lowest level, I have, knowing the natural environment. And this would be like knowing the geology or the biomes or the wildlife, so on. And a level above that is the built environment, which is really fascinating here in Arizona. There's this book on the Mormon landscape that talks about, the traditional layout of Mormon villages and stuff, and so that whole thing, or the architecture of Salt Lake or so on, public buildings, is an important way of knowing the region. Then the next level up is what I call historic or cultural studies. You should know a little about the history, the cultural forces or movements or stages of development in the area. Then, kind of related to that, but another level up is the local literature and legends. In each of these corners, you have local authors that write about the region, the area, or their love for it, or the history of it. And you also have legends, folklores, particularly like in San Pete County, there's these books on legends, the Scandinavian legends, and so on. Each of these corners has its own legend. Then the next level up would be what I call iconic arts and crafts. And Each of these regions has a distinctive art history and art culture. The New Mexico one is probably the most well known. When you think of southwestern art or crafts, you think of Santa Fe and Taos, the artists that made famous the Hispanic and the Pueblo communities there. So I think of this as devotional fusion, the culture here. You initially had the Hispanics' devotion and their crafts, their religious icons and so on. And then later you had European-trained artists coming in and kind of a fusion. And culturally, it was a fusion there, too, between the Hispanics that lived there and the Anglos that came in as traders and married into the families and so on. So that's one culture. Then Utah has a distinctive culture, which I think of as pioneer pastoral. If you think of Utah art, you think of all the kind of pastoral settings. Well, you see around here the little barns and everything and landscapes, and it's infused with a kind of pastoral spirit, I think, and that a lot of that has to do with the Mormon tradition and so on, and the pioneer. So I call that pioneer pastoral. Over here in Denver, I call this rocky operations, where you have you know, the Rocky Mountain artist, and then the mining, the railroad, pictures of railroads and so on. Here in the center is kind of the native heartland. You think of famous Navajo painters like Gorham or others that have made a name for them more recently. And you think of the Hopi art and the Zuni art. This is kind of I like this bolo because it symbolizes kind of the four directions, the four areas. The stones are also the Hopi or the Navajo. The stones characterize different directions or different colors. So you have the east is typically white. The east is typically either white. The south is either red or blue. The west is yellow, and the north, which represents night, is black. So this kind of represents that. Okay. So any questions so far?
Seven.
The seven. Seven would just be the stem here, which cuts through all the regions.
Okay, right.
Okay, so in trying to look deeper at the clashes, and there's a long tradition of geopolitics. I don't know how many of you have heard the term geopolitics. Sometimes it's used just generally to talk about people controlling the land and trying to take the land, like oil companies or something. But there's a long European tradition of looking at how power and territory relate. The theories about the heartland, or if you control a certain area, you have intrinsic power, or land or sea power. If you're interested in that, you can look it up at Wiki. Wiki has a good summary of geopolitics. And I started thinking that, while it's generally used in international politics or applied, I think it also applies regionally or could be applied regionally, particularly to this region. I mean, if you think of the different cultural forces that came in, each of them had a distinctive geopolitics or what I call geocultural politics, because I want to emphasize the cultural aspects of it and distinguish mine from other cultural things. I think of the archetypes that represent the different cultural forces, like Adams did with the dynamo and the virgin. And I came up with seven distinctive kind of archetypes that kind of correspond to the to nine directions. And I'll start with the eastern ones. So I mean, at due east, I think of the New Mexican trader as an important archetype of the first, the mountain men who kind of were based, a lot of them based out of Taos, that did trading, and then later people that traded with the Santa Fe on the Santa Fe Trail, and after it became part of the U.S., they came in and married people and land grants and so on. So I think that's a real important archetype. And the geopolitics of the trader was to, trade. I mean, basically by finding an area where he could control the trade routes or trade lines was important. Then up north to the northeast, you have the operator. And I think there are the miners particularly, or mine owners, the railroaders and the railroad operators. And you can think of, like ski operators or later operators too. But so that was an important archetype. And then down south, you have the stockman, the cowboys and stockmen from Texas that came up from Texas with their herds and settled in this area. So those are the three kind of eastern architects. And then on the western side, you also have three. The main one in the northwest here is the colonizer, the Mormon colonizers that came in and settled the corridor and so on. And then you have put to the due west, the natives that were kind of enduring but tended to be forced further and further west. So you had all the different tribes here, the Utes and the Paiutes and the Navajos and the Hopi and so on. And then to the south here, I just put what I call the agent. And this was the Fed agents that had a big role and still have a big role. I mean, a lot of the clashes today are between the Feds and like this new law about taking over land and so on. So these clashes between archetypes, you can see the past, like the frontiers in terms of these, but you can also see contemporary ones. And then in the center, I have three additional archetypes that I think of the one archetype. I think of the daughter of the Deep West, the women that came out and settled the West. And I think, you know, for in terms of analysis, it's appropriate. Although all these others could be women also, it's appropriate to have a daughter archetype. And then I think of the guide or teacher. You can have hyphenated, like you could have a Native guide or a Mormon guide or cowboy guide or, you know. But these are the people that, you know, kind of give wisdom. And I've particularly been guided by, you know, some people in thinking about knowing the Deep West, like Powell, the original John Wesley Powell, who I think of as the original kind of frugal explorer. I think of myself as kind of a frugal explorer of the Deep West, of trying to dig deeper, but in a modest and inexpensive way. And then at the center you have kind of the enduring maverick, which is can be the renegade or the trickster or the cowboy who's gone bad or so on. Very important. Important character, particularly as I've said in Arizona, which you know, kind of, there's a dominant cowboy kind of mentality, and we produce mavericks, you know, both on Udall type mavericks and also you know, mainly Republican mavericks these days. But so I would argue that you know, most traditional clashes and contemporary clashes could be seen in terms of you know, conflicts between one or more of these, like the early Mormon settling of the corridor here and Dixie and so on. You could see particularly as a clash between the colonizers, the natives like the Paiutes and the Utes that had to be forced out or made way for, and then the agents, the federal agents that were always at odds with the Mormon colonizers and so on. And then you also had, later on, you had stockmen coming up here and into like this area. So each kind of corner you can see in terms of these different... so how are we on time?
15 minutes.
15 minutes. Okay, any questions on those archetypes?
Maybe I could ask one thing, and that is, where would the environmentalists fit into that, or is it that too modern to be relevant?
I would put that as a guide, like guide or teacher. I mean, some people might not put it there, but I have like sort of seven kind of general guides that I think are similar to your general authorities there, you know, that Powell's kind of my traditional one, and then I Wallace Stigner and Terry Tempest Williams, who I think of as an environmentalist as well as a writer. I mean, I think of them as kind of mother and father figures, and then I have four others that are more kind of regional. Edward Gerry, I don't know if any of you know his book on the proper view of the sky, which I think is a kind of model for what I'd want to do, and one of the best books on kind of the high plateau area. And he also, I mean, he talks about there being different levels that when you try to get to know a region, you have to think of the different levels. So he's one, and then the artist Maynard Dixon, I think of his work as kind of typical of the Deep West, the spirit of the Deep West. Frank Walters is another one, and Edward Abbey. So those are kind of seven people that I think of as kind of guides to knowing the Deep West deeper. Okay. So I think each of these different archetypes or cultural forces had a history in coming into the region from different corners of it and trying to colonize it, establishing frontiers in which different cultural forces controlled different sides of the frontier or wanted to be in control of the frontier. So, and each of them, I think, had somewhat distinctive ways of their geopolitics or ways of trying to control the territory was different. So you had, the Mormons initially trekking out here, and then the whole idea of controlling Deseret, trying to control the whole area by basically controlling the rivers and, you know, the small rivers and stream. It was an agricultural geopolitics, and so the idea here was to build these twin corridors, through San Pete and also down here on the Mormon corridor, and building colonies each time you found little water rivers, and that not only sustained the community, but it also kept others from being able to settle there. Then you had the operators, the railroaders and miners. Geopolitics was mainly control the mining districts, control the mines, and build the railroads to the mines so you could take away the coal and stuff. So you had the railroad along here, Union Pacific, but then you quickly had the Rio Grande Railroad being built down this way, and then the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe here. A real good example of geopolitics was the race for Raton Pass there, where both of them were racing towards. There was a narrow pass here, and whoever got there first controlled that whole route there. So the Rio Grande missed out there; they didn't quite make it. So they had to reconstruct their plant there and head on up this way. And then basically spending spurs out to the mining districts and controlling the different districts in the Rockies. Then you had down here in Santa Fe, you had the traders, the Hispanic traders and Anglo traders that basically controlled the trade. I mean, you had the rings, like the Santa Fe rings and different rings that controlled trading and stuff. And so that was kind of a geopolitical strategy of controlling trading areas. You also had, eventually you had railroads running down here and settling along the railroad and controlling that. Then you had stockmen moving up here from Texas there into the areas. And their basic geopolitics was controlling the range, controlling the water hole. And rather than trying to buy up all the land, they just try to settle, have control of the places that had water holes, and then they could control vast areas there. And you had a whole interesting history here of like the Hash Knife outfit. It was the biggest group was capitalized by Easterners and used the railroad land out here, the railroad across here to try to control this whole area. And so you had the clash between the stockmen and the Mormons here. This is all in kind of the Little River Valley down here. And so in studying the geopolitics, the traditional geopolitics, you can think of these cultural forces and how they tried to control the land. There's a good book by Reeves called Making Space on the Frontier, where he talks about right this area right here and the clashes between the Mormons, the Paiutes, and the miners that were coming in from this area. And I also think you'd have to add the agents here, because the federal had a big factor there. In fact, they took a big hunk of Utah away and gave it to Nevada because the miners wanted it. So I think this approach that's evolving is a good way of getting at some of the cultural clashes and may be useful to Mormons, historians are thinking about Mormons and how they've clashed with other cultures. And you could also bring it up to the contemporary times. I mean, I think there's probably a Mormon geopolitics now but it's more global. I mean, how do you use temples and stuff to control your population in different areas and stuff? So I think we're about out of time. I think we got a couple minutes for questions and stuff, but I was going to give some more specific examples of like a little Colorado example and stuff, but I think I'll stop on that with just a contemporary note of if you think this is just historically. I mean, it hit me pretty hard. My family has some land in Duchesne County there in the Uinta Basin that we haven't done much with for 40 years, but it's always been nice to know it's there. And suddenly, about 3 months ago, an oil company called up and said, hey, we want your land for an oil well and some right-of-ways and stuff. And so I had to quickly try to learn about what our rights were. We don't control the mineral rights, so our rights are limited to surface rights. But that whole area is very interesting in terms of geopolitics. You have the oil operators coming in from this happened to be a Colorado-based company, but them coming in and trying to control the basin. And then you have the Mormon presence there that's still strong, and they are somewhat ambivalent about these things. Then you have the Utes there. That there's been, there's constant tension between the Utes and the local population about who controls the law enforcement or the land or stuff. So you have that architect, and then you have, it's just full of agencies. I found out that there are, at least three or four agencies that are involved in regulating or have a say in our deal with the oil company or whether they'll build these oil wells along the Strawberry River. There's the state agency Dogma and there's the Bureau of Land Management, which gets into it because the Utes control the mineral rights, and there's the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Since the Utes are involved, they're involved, and so it's a whole interesting process. And I think this whole archetypal cultural archetypes kind of fits into better understanding those kind of contemporary or historic clashes. So I'll stop there. I want to thank you all for bearing with me, and I hope there have been a few interesting things. I just think this approach might be useful to you that live in Utah, or Mormons or non-Mormons, but think in terms of how can I better define this place or be more comfortable in how I live in it. So any questions, comments, reactions?
Well, you see a lot of applications with Utah desire to get back to federal lands.
Yeah, I mean, that's
and then the power plant that is proposed for the Book Cliffs area. Uh-huh. All of these, you can see then these archetypal conflicts at work.
Yeah, and I think the thing I would emphasize is that it's not just politics or public policy. There's deep cultural things under that. And so the clash between the feds, on this land, I mean, there are a lot of roots of it, but it also goes back to the whole history of the feds dominating the area. I mean, in Arizona, we have the same kind of anti-Fed feeling that they control too much of the land and so on, and the Tea Party wants to get the land back and so on. So, yeah. Oh, any reaction?
No, that's good.
Okay, well, thank you all for bearing with me. It's been, this is the first time I've kind of, I've been thinking about this for 20 years, and this is the first time I've kind of gone public with it, and I hope to maybe do a blog or website eventually. But I, you know, I appreciate your questions and stuff, and feel it was kind of appropriate to do this at a Sunstone. I find a lot of the presenters here are just getting ready to launch a website or a blog or a new campaign or stuff. So this Sunstone seems to be a good incubator for this. So hope you enjoy the rest of the sessions.